Okay, so let's start with Paleozoic terrestrial reptiles. So you can see here that on this picture that these guys are kind of starting to look like dinosaurs. Some of them are not really considered dinosaurs because it is the Paleozoic. It's not the Mesozoic. But I think you'll notice some similarities between the two, where you're kind of like, oh yeah, that might be kind of looking like a dinosaur. Sorry for the resolution of this picture, but you can see here, this is a picture of modern reptiles. There's a picture of a frog. You can see an iguana, a snake, a turtle. A land turtle is the one with the bulbous body on the right, like a desert turtle. And then you have a pond or a sea turtle sitting over on the left. And then this looks like a little lizard down to the south. Hi, how are you? No, you're okay, don't worry. All right, so this is the branch or the tree of life, if you will, for reptiles. You can see that it's it's not exactly straightforward. So there's lots of little branches and segues and stuff that lead you from our amphibian ancestors. And essentially reptiles evolved from amphibians. You can see here down at the bottom of the tree, or sort of at the base, is the amphibian ancestor. And then you'll see that from the amphibians, it's thought that turtles evolved from there. And then also all these different dinosaurs, the plesiosaurs, that one lived in the water. Ichthyosaurus, that's sort of a dinosaur, dolphin sort of creature. And then also over here are lizards and snakes. They would have ultimately evolved from amphibians coming through this branch right through here. And then also coming up, if you continue to climb up the tree, you can see that there are crocodiles that kind of come over here onto the left. And then you have like the proper dinosaurs that we'll learn about in the Mesozoic. And then you have the ones that that essentially turned into birds. So the Archaeopteryx, and then the this guy sitting over here, this is what you see like in some of the movies and stuff like that, is this guy. And then ultimately mammals would have evolved over here, over on the right hand side. This is the, I believe, the Latin word for mammals, and this is the Latin word for birds sitting up here. So it's really cool. In a way, like, I never would have really expected everything to be so closely related. But then if you kind of think about it, like, oh, crocodiles, they kind of do look like modern versions of dinosaurs. Like, when you kind of look at them, you could maybe in your mind think of it that way. So, so it's really cool. And these all first started to appear in the Paleozoic during the Mississippian time period. So if you guys remember, we've been going through geologic time, and you have your little chart in the front of your lab book, and this guy right here behind the main cover. And if you look to where the Mississippian is, according to this geologic time scale, which I'm not sure how up to date it is, but it says that it began 358 million years ago and lasted until 318 million years ago. So this guy would have been really a long, long time ago, in the middle, towards the middle to the end of the Paleozoic. Okay, so reptiles compared to amphibians. Overall, they're better adapted to living on land and as a predator. So a lot of times amphibians, they will go between water and the land, and they have to keep their skin wet, essentially, or they'll dry out. But reptiles are considered to be better adapted just because they have that tougher skin, and they may need the water like to drink or to lay their eggs or rely on it for a resource, but they don't necessarily have to have the water. So if you notice that in some drier climates, like out here, we would I'm not sure if we would have reptiles necessarily in the desert, but they can withstand much drier, harsher climates compared to like an amphibian, something like that. Here's a list of their characteristics over on the left-hand side of the slide. They have a stronger jaw. That's due to the development of muscles. They have a long pointed teeth. They have eyes on either side of their head. So they're not in the front, they're on the sides. They have longer limbs. They have a less sprawling posture. So they kind of sit a little bit upright. And I think it's a little bit more obvious on this picture. And then also to note that they have sharp claws, so they can climb on things. Amphibians, I think, can climb on things too, but They're probably, what's that?
Don't they stick?
Yeah, they kind of have those little stickies, like the little geckos and stuff. But I would say that these are probably, the sharper claws are more advanced for, like, you know, being able to hold things and grip onto things, maybe to eat things or to dig things when they lay their eggs, stuff like that. They also have scales, and they have a special type of egg. So it's like semi-soft sort of egg. It's not necessarily like a chicken egg, if you will. Okay, so it's hard-shelled and it's self-contained. This is what a reptile egg looks like. The juvenile will develop within the egg until it's able to survive by itself. So there's no tadpole stage. That's a fundamental difference between reptiles and amphibians. So when you're dealing with frogs and like little geckos and things like that, they always have the tadpole stage where they're living in like a body of water, like a little pond or what have you. And the little tadpoles kind of are mini fish and they swim around. So yeah, so that's not present with your reptiles. And they don't necessarily need to be tied to water to reproduce. So that was something I had mentioned on the previous slide, that this need for water is not as great when you're dealing with reptiles. Okay, so within the Paleozoic, there are three types of reptiles that appear within the Paleozoic time frame. They are distinguished by their eye and the number and position of holes that are behind the eye. So the holes that you see in their skull are used to lighten the skull so it's not as heavy, and for muscle attachment, and it allows for the animal to grow, because reptiles, amphibians are generally pretty small, but if you're at all familiar with like iguanas or even chameleons, but some people, I mean, if you have an iguana as a pet, they can actually get to be quite large. There are three types of reptiles, as I had said. These are the words. I don't necessarily expect you guys to remember the specific names, but it would be good to know that there are three different types, okay? So I'm not going to be really stringent about the vocabulary, but know that there's three types, and essentially the three types are divided on whether the amount of holes in its skull. So the first type has no holes in its skull. The second type has one, and then the third type has two. So that would be most important, because I know sometimes it's those words are like learning a new language. So I'm not going to necessarily quiz you on the actual vocabulary. Okay, so here is a skull of an apsid, and there are no holes. These holes right here, those are the eye sockets. Those don't count. This is a primitive form, so it's the most basic form. Typically, it's a small size. So you see that the scale bar over here at the bottom of the photo is 100 millimeters. So it's quite tiny. They're very minor importance in the Paleozoic. So they did not dominate the Paleozoic by any means. Just a very small number of fossils in this sort of category. And these gave rise to the turtles. So essentially, this is what turtles would have evolved from. Here is a drawing on the reptile skull structure. You can see here the different types. So the no holes is sitting down at the bottom. And then essentially they evolved. This is like another one of those little tree diagrams. And you see the synapsid over here on the right, and then the diapsid, and then the uriapsid. So these are just the three basic types that had holes in them that developed from the one at the bottom with no holes. And then from there, they further evolved into mammals, birds, lizards, snakes. And I'm not sure what this guy is sitting over here on the left-hand side. Anyways, these are the most important for you to know. So diapsids. So this is when you have two holes in the skull. They're also minor importance in the Paleozoic, but they were very, very dominant. They led to the rise of the dinosaurs in the Mesozoic, which is something we'll talk about in a couple weeks. And then here you can just see that this figure is annotated, just all the different names of the different cavities. So you have the nose hole sitting over here. You have the eye hole sitting over here. This is their teeth. And then back here would have sit the brain would have been located. And then this is where the holes are that would have been around the brain. Okay, and then here we go to synapsids, so one hole. This is the most dominant form of life in the Paleozoic. It was the most abundant, the most diverse, and the largest of all the reptiles. So the single hole in the head was the largest. We consider these are, in quotes, mammal-like reptiles. And we call them that because essentially we think that they were ancestors to the mammals. The two groups in the Paleozoic are these two words down here. So Pliocosaurus and then Theraapsids. So sorry if I pronounced some of them wrong. Okay, so now we'll go within the one holes. There's two groups. So this is the first group, the Pliocosaurus. The age ranges from the Pennsylvanian to the early Permian. So that's generally, that's considered to be the end of the Paleozoic. So the Pennsylvanian began about 318 million years ago, and the Permian ended 250 million years ago. There's a good fossil record of these in the American Southwest. So we have them here in West Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah. They were believed to be both predators and herbivores, the first vertebrate order herbivores. And just remember, anything that we say is a vertebrate is something that has a spine. So it has a spine in its back. When we talk about invertebrates on Thursday, remember those are going to be like your corals and things that generally live in the sea, arthropods. It'll also be like your gastropods, which are snail shells, things like that. Like just things with squishy bits that did not have a spine. Generally, we think of this group of life to be restricted to the tropics and subtropics, like modern reptiles are. So places now that we have crocodiles, alligators, Komodo dragons, and goannas, that would have been a similar environment for this group. So you generally not the desert, so not here. So even though we find the fossil record is here, this was once in the tropics to subtropics, okay? So it's just, it's changed environments since the Pennsylvanian to the early Permian. All right, so this is what some of them would have looked like. They kind of look dinosaur-like. You can see here that the largest in our fossil record is approximately 3 meters long. You can basically think of 1 meter is about a yardstick, so sort of like your wingspan, so three times that. And they would have weighed, on average, approximately 220 pounds. I don't think I would have wanted to come in contact with one of these guys. Even though they're a reptile, think of it like an oversized iguana or like a goanna or something like that. So what was the purpose of the fin? So we see now a lot of modern reptiles, they may have a little bit of a fin. Like iguanas kind of have those little group of spikes that sit up along their spine and their back. But overall, back then, why would they have needed the fin? There are two hypotheses written on the slide. It could have been perhaps to regulate the body temperature in a hot, low latitude climate. So maybe like a fan or used to shade itself. I don't know, maybe. And then also think of it perhaps as maybe a territorial or a sexual display. So, you know, when peacocks raise up their feathers, that's typically the males that do that. And they do that to attract attention or to attract a mate. So could they have done that for that purpose, for mating purposes? Key thing to note that Dimetrodon is not a dinosaur. So that's a key thing. It may look dinosaur-like, but it is a reptile. It's approximately 50 million years older than the first dinosaur, and it is not on the same evolutionary path. So it's not on the same tree branch as dinosaurs, even though it looks like it. But then that's all based on those holes in its head. Therapsids. So this is the second group. The age range for this guy and this group is late Permian to early Triassic. So relatively short lifespan. So the late Permian would have been, looking at our geologic time scale, oh gosh, maybe about 275 million years ago until the early Triassic. So maybe 225 million years ago. These fossils are common in South Africa and Russia, and they're present at high latitudes, which would have been cold during that time period. so relatively cold-weathered animals. Really interesting-looking guy. They were predators and herbivores. And remember, they can tell whether or not it ate meat or it was a vegetarian based on its teeth structure. They had a less sprawling posture than the previous one that we looked at, the Pliocosaurus. All right, so going from these guys, these reptiles, to mammals. When we start setting up our tree, a branch, an evolutionary branch on this slide, there are many clear transition forms. So the synapsid 30 million years ago, this is what they would have looked like sitting over here on the left-hand side of the screen. And this is just sort of a generalized skull, if you will. The therapsid, these are the guys that have the two holes. And then this is an early kynodont sitting over here, and then a light kynodont sitting over here. So as you go over through here, the diapsids and the anapsids, including turn into reptiles, those include the dinosaurs and the birds. And then the synapsids are a completely different branch. So that's where you have the divergence, is this branch over here, then this branch over here. And these ultimately evolve into mammals sitting down over here. So this is kind of where you have the split between the reptiles and then the mammals. Go ahead.
So these are still the ones with the one hole, right?
Yes.
And mm-hmm. So then you have two groups, the
yep.
And
yep.
The therapsid,
yeah, yeah.
And which one goes to the mammals?
Which one goes to the mammals?
Yes.
This one, the synapsid. So if you go back, where's our original list? This one, the one hole synapsid, that goes into mammals right here. And then the anapsids and the diapsid, those two, go into reptiles that include dinosaurs and birds. Does that help?
Okay, so reptiles go from the no holes and the two holes.
Yes.
And the mammals go from the one
hole. Yes.
But the mammals, they were like the two groups that we just talked about?
Yeah.
So both of those groups go to mammals?
Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
Both synapses.
Oh, okay. Yep, they're both synapses. Yes.
Okay.
Good. Yes. That's a great, thank you for clarifying, because that's really important to know conceptually, like for a test question. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Cool. Thank you for clarifying. Okay. So now talking a bit more about mammals. Mammals have stronger jaws. That's one characteristic. The lower jaw of a mammal is a single bone, and the reptiles have multiple bones along their bottom jaw. So that might be why the mammals have a stronger jaw, is because you're dealing with a single jawbone. It's not broken up into all these segments. So that's a key characteristic, a difference between the mammals and the reptiles. Additionally, mammals have differentiated teeth. So reptile teeth are typically all the same type, and they're constantly being replaced. So a reptile loses a tooth, then a new tooth grows in, and it's just this long process. Mammals, on the other hand, they have incisors, they have canines, they have molars, they have different types of teeth, and typically, like for humans, we only lose them once, and then they grow, we have adult teeth, if you will, and then that's all you get. Mammals, other types of mammals work the same way, where you may only lose them once, or you may only have the single set, and yeah, there's not this constant sort of regeneration of teeth. Unfortunately, exactly. Okay, another characteristic. The mammal jaw joint points forward. So here we have mammal jaw joint moved forward with some of the bones formerly used as a joint that eventually turn into the inner ear. So that's another thing to consider, is over time, over hundreds of million years, sort of all these evolutionary aspects start to change the structure of the skull and how the muscles are attached to the bone. The reptile jaw joint is in the back of the skull. So here you can see an early mammal, the location of the jaw joint and where the jaw would have been. And it's a single bone sitting right here, this cartoon. And then over here you have the jawbone also located in the back, but you also see how the jawbone has been segmented. It's in these different sort of pieces sitting down over here. And then notice how the shape of the top of the skull is generally different as well. It's a little bit more bulbous than non-mammals and the reptiles. All right, here's another characteristic that's different with mammals. They have a bone that forms on the roof of the mouth. This forces the air from the nostrils into the back of the throat, and it allows mammals to eat and breathe at the same time. So that's a key diagnostic feature. And if you think of it, if you just think about how your own mouth is, you can breathe and eat at the same time. And it's because your nose holes are connected to the top, above your, the roof of your mouth, essentially. Okay, another thing, we have something called a secondary palate. So here is the nasal cavity sitting back over here. This is the mouth sitting back in here. And then our secondary palate separates the two, this sort of section right in here. So yeah, I can just kind of make a little list of all the characteristics. All right, so that's the end of that one, the land reptiles. So now we will move on to the land mammals, or land animals, excuse me. So Paleozoic terrestrial animals. This guy, he looks pretty creepy looking. Okay, so animal life moves on to land. When animal life moves on to land, there are three major groups. So now we're going a little bit more broad. We're dealing with arthropods. You can think of bugs and insects, essentially, amphibians, and then reptiles. Terrestrial arthropods. So these are the first animals to move onto the land, and this would have happened in the late Silurian. So I apologize. This is actually, we're going a little bit further back in time than the first presentation. So the Silurian would have been 444 million years ago to 416 million years ago. These are millipedes and mites, and they would have ate decaying plant debris. And then you can also think of spiders and scorpions who would have then eaten the millipedes and the mites. And over on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see that there are two fossil pictures of. One is the centipede over on the upper right, and then the scorpion, fossilized scorpion, is sitting down over in the lower right. Yeah. Another thing that appeared is flying insects. These guys, this is massive, 70 centimeters. You can see that woman holding a picture of it. Or a model, a clay model, if you will. These appeared in the Pennsylvanian. The Pennsylvanian was approximately 318 to 299 million years ago, so slightly younger than the millipedes and the scorpions and the mites and the things from the first slide. The earliest had permanently extended wings, so these would have been similar or considered a dragonfly. So when you see dragonflies now, they're about this big. This one would have been huge. It's followed by folded wings. So things that would have then appeared would have been things like cockroaches and beetles would have evolved after this. All right, so just a comparison of what a human looks like and a modern day hawk sitting over here. The Paleozoic dragonflies would have been similar size to large birds of prey that we have now. So absolutely massive dragonflies. And then nowadays you can see that this is the comparison of what a dragonfly is now. So relatively small. And the earliest dinosaur you can see here is about a meter long.
What made them get
smaller? Smaller over time? That's a good question. What could have happened, just throwing out some ideas, I don't really know the exact answer to it, but some of the ideas I have are the climate is different. Also, over time, things tend to get bigger and larger, generally speaking. Like, this is a phenomenon that we see in a lot of different animal groups. So at one time, horses were like a foot tall, little tiny horses, like, you know, tens of millions of years ago. Yeah, so in the Cenozoic, and we'll talk about that kind of stuff. So I'm not sure if we know exactly, but typically we think of it as a change of environment. Also depending on predator and prey. So if this guy, he may have been too big to really be eaten by something else, but maybe at some point something did decide to eat him and he could have gone extinct. So it didn't serve him well to be large. A lot of times too, depending on what food is available. So whatever it is that they're eating, that might cause them to change size and shape as well. So there's generally a lot of factors that go into it. So it's going to be the environment, the food that's available, the temperature, what it evolved from, things like that. But specifically, I'm not sure why that guy is no longer, why we don't see gigantic dragonflies anymore. I would bet it probably had something to do with the climate mostly. All right, so here, going into insect flight strategy. So just talking a little bit more about their wings. Wings are essentially modified gill branches. So you can think of like the gills in a fish, how they're moving a lot, and that's where they suck in the water. Wings are essentially branches that operate, or they have sort of the same function. Wings are composed of mostly dead tissue. And the advantage of wings is that they didn't have to use a set of legs in order to make the wing supports. So they can just kind of operate with their wings. They don't necessarily need legs. The disadvantage is that the wings are actually very fragile and they can't be repaired. So that's one sad thing. Like if you see a butterfly that has a damaged wing or a moth, typically once they're damaged, they can't regenerate or regrow. So they typically will end up dying. And as a result of these evolutionary aspects, it has a short lifespan as a winged insect, and it doesn't use the wings as much or shed the wings after the initial use. So typically the winged insects, they just don't live very long. All right, colonial insects. So this is insects that would have lived together in groups. So you can think of it as ants, termites, bees, and wasps. They typically have like a hive or a place where they're all going to live together. We consider these in the rock record to be colonial trace fossils. And just to note that these did not appear until the Mesozoic. So even though we're talking about the Paleozoic insects, colonial insects did not appear till the Mesozoic. All right. So the insect fossil record, how is it preserved? So we see their trace fossils, evidence of past life. Typically, what will happen is, or luckily, is that a lot of these insects will be encased in amber, and that is what will preserve them. These are pictures of mites sitting over on the right-hand side over here. These direct fossils are rare because the exoskeleton is made out of chitin. Chitin, you can think of like your fingernails. So, and to preserve like a fingernail would probably be pretty hard over time. It would just, you know, disappear essentially because it is organic matter. So the fact that you use the tree sap to then encase it, that will preserve it for a much longer period of time than if the insect was just, you know, buried in some sand or something. It will most likely just disappear if it would be in the sand because of its organic. Yeah. The only thing with this, though, the only caveat is fossil or the tree sap only goes back to the Pennsylvanian. So the Pennsylvanian was approximately 318 to 299 million years ago. So that's when tree sap would have evolved. So unfortunately, any of the insects that are older than that, because there was no tree sap around, you don't see them preserved that way. And then also, if you guys remember carbonization from last week, that's where it has sort of that blackish rock. I think we had the fossil fish sitting in the back. And it's essentially like a little imprint in like black or brown. That's carbonization, if you guys remember. Those are also pretty rare in the rock record. Our main line of evidence typically comes from trace fossils. So it would have been where they would have grazed and they would have fed. So you can see here on the right-hand side of the slide, there are, this is sedimentary rock. So this is a sandstone, and these are horizontal laminae, these horizontal lines right here. And then you can see this right here. This is going to be your feeding or your grazing burrow. So this guy, whoops, this guy would have actually been alive, like at this time period, if you will, and then it would have burrowed down into the sediment to eat the organic matter that was sitting in the sandstone. So that's more more of a common way that we knew insects were present during the Paleozoic, is through this means, rather than preserving the actual body fossils. Additionally, there are insects walking traces. So you can see little, if you will, little footprints. They aren't footprints, but this one is interpreted to be a scorpion walking traces. So just their little feet kind of walking across the sand. That would have been one. Amphibians. So going back to this, this is from the phylum Chordatia, and then it is a vertebrate. So it has a spine. The second land animal to appear in the Paleozoic, it first appeared in the latest Devonian. So the Devonian is from 316 to 359 million years ago, so at the very end. So maybe around 360 million years ago. And then just to note that amphibians, they would have ultimately evolved from lobe-finned bony fishes. So you would have had the fish living in the sea, and then it would have started, it would have left the sea and kind of lived in the sea, lived on the land. Yeah, really, really cool stuff. So here's just another depiction of how amphibians evolved from the lobe-finned bony fishes. So the fin bones evolved into legs, essentially, is what we think. So the fins of the fish, that would have enabled them to swim around, they would have eventually started using those fins as feet, and then those feet would have then been able to walk out of the water and onto the land. It is kind of weird. It's just, it happens over such a long period of time. It's hard for us to really relate to it. Yeah. So this is a little bit more detailed, going from lobe fin, so the fins, to the feet. There's all these little evolutionary steps. So it's not that one day a fish wakes up and says, oh, I think I'm going to walk on land today. It doesn't really happen that way. It typically happens through a series of trials and failed experiments. So you this specific type of sort of, if you will, hybrid fish amphibian will start to form, and then it'll live for so long, and then it might die off, and then you'll have another branch of life that starts. So this is sort of all the different branches, and right now there's always sort of the question mark of what little guy, because these three definitely look like fish, these definitely have feet that look more like amphibians. So where's that link where you kind of go from one to the other? What sort of animal would have filled that space? And that's, I think, where if you ever decide to get into paleontology, that's sort of where all the leading research takes place, is sort of making that link. What was the exact fossil that decided or sort of evolved from going living in the water to being on the land? I think that that's really the interesting part about paleontology, is understanding that. So additionally, not only do you have to think about the feet itself, going from fins to feet, but also how it breathes. Because remember, fish, they can use their gills and they breathe in the water. And then amphibians have a set of lungs to be able to breathe the regular air. So so the lungs would have evolved, they think, from a modified air bladder that would have originally been used to control its buoyancy. And if you remember, or if you're familiar, buoyancy is essentially the ability for the fish to kind of go up and down in the water column. So yeah, so this is just sort of a hypothesis. And then just to remember, all the references on the slides are down here. So if you ever are curious or want to learn a little bit more information, you can just click on that link, and that'll take you to more information. All right. So nowadays we have modern lobe fin fishes. There are two types. One is the lungfish. Maybe you guys have actually heard of that. And then this is the other type. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce that guy. It's like colocanth. this guy sitting right here. What's really cool about this one, so this has a story, the Colacanth was thought to be extinct until the 1940s when a fisherman hauled it up from the Indian Ocean. So it lives really, really deep down at the bottom of the ocean.
Is there still fish like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're really, really deep, though. Mm-hmm. Not very common. Hopefully. I mean, you never know. Things are going extinct all the time nowadays, so... Okay, and then the lungfish. So maybe you guys are a little bit familiar with that. This is a modern example of the lungfish. There is one genus each in Australia, in South Africa, and South America. They live in strongly seasonal, wet, dry climates. What'll happen is in the dry season, they dig a deep burrow into the mud and slow down their metabolism. And it'll then begin to breathe with its lungs. And then they're also capable of crawling across the dry land from the water hole to the water and use its fins. So these are essentially fish that when it gets really dry or dries out, they can use their lungs to breathe, but they still can go in the water. So they're adapted to be in both environments. So really cool things. All right, so this is lungfish traces. So this is their bioturbation, so where we see them in the rock record. You can see here these little, so this is sort of an artist's rendition of what a lungfish would have been doing. So you can see it kind of burrows down into the sediment over here. And you can see these guys. So this is, these are going to be the wave ripples over here. And then this are, these are the burrows sitting down over here. The fossil record of the transition from lobed fin fishes to amphibians. So we think that there are approximately nine genera spanning about 20 million years. So it would have taken these guys going from fish to amphibians approximately 20 million years to evolve. So it takes a long, long time. These fossils have been collected from the Appalachian Mountains, Northern Europe, Greenland, and Australia, and then also within the subtropic region. So it would have been relatively warm, and they would have had wet season and then a dry season. So that's what would have kind of allowed them to evolve, is this changing in environment. Cool. And then here is another tree, or branches of life, if you will. You can see that the geologic timescale is over here on the left. So you have the Devonian, and that would have been approximately beginning 260 million years ago. So you have these types of... like lungfish, if you will. And then from there, it would have evolved through geologic time to the lobe-finned fishes from the Jurassic all the way to the recent. And then you have the amphibians that ultimately then, once you have the amphibians, they're divided between salamanders and frogs, if you will. And then you have the reptile branch sitting over here. So all of these more modern types all would have essentially evolved from these fish sitting way down here during the Devonian. All right, so now we're gonna go through the transition of the genera, the genus, through time. And genus is just, if you're looking at sort of the branch of how you name things, it's an easy way, or it's the way in which we classify some of these fossils. So the transition from the fish to the amphibians, these guys would have been variable in size, 3 centimeters to 3 meters long. And then just to note that the first ones, the earliest life forms, were approximately 1 meter. So key morphological changes going from the fish to the amphibians. They would have developed toes, the amphibians, and this is so they can distribute their weight. They would have had interlocking vertebrae, so backbone, and that's to increase the strength so they can actually walk on their feet. They would have had elongated ribs, so this supports the body out of the water, and then the separation of the skull from the shoulder blade. So if you think of fish, the distinction between the head and the body of the fish is kind of like all one thing, but with reptiles, you would have then had the separation. So essentially think of, they would have had like a neck, not, they don't really have necks, but like their head would have been a little bit more detached, so then they can look around with their head. So they can move their head independently of their body. Where if you look at fish, like modern fish, when they move their head, kind of the whole upper half of their body moves with the head. All right, so common features of Paleozoic amphibians. Typically, what we see in the fossil record is that they had a flat skull. Their eyes and the nostrils were at the top of their head. You can see here in the picture, these are the eye holes sitting right here. The legs are relatively short, and they're, of course, would have been off to the side. And then they have a thick, long tail sitting down here. These features, we can interpret it to be that they probably spent most of their time in the water. Amphibian reproduction. All right, so these guys, they would have produced in standing water. This we also see today. Like when you go to some areas and you see little tadpoles, typically they're going to be in little isolated bodies of water, like little tiny ponds. And they do that basically to protect the tadpoles, because if they were to just lay the eggs out in the open water, all the other fish, things would eat them, essentially. So they're pretty strategic with where they put their eggs. The sperm must have swum to the egg to produce the juvenile. So this would have taken place like in the pond or in the water. And then as a result, the amphibians, generally, they would live in wet climates and they would live near bodies of water. So near ponds, rivers, or lakes. And typically they are not thought to colonize in drylands. So when you're kind of dealing out in the desert, the drylands, that's not really an optimal place for amphibians. You're more likely to see them down like by the Rio, down by the river. All right, so this kind of may have answered your question before. So why would they move to land? So what would have caused a fish or an amphibian to then move onto land and become a reptile? So food, potentially. I'm not sure if we'll ever really know the answer to this, but it's postulated that perhaps food. So maybe the plants and the bugs that were on the land were appealing to them. Maybe they liked how they taste. I know that there's, I have to show you guys, there is a Planet Earth video of like fish that kind of come up and pop up and they eat like little things that sit on land. We see this today. This is a modern day phenomenon. So I kind of think that's maybe where this hypothesis come from. And then also perhaps they would have moved to land to form reptiles to keep their eggs away from all the scavengers and the predators in the water. So back then, there wasn't any real predators sitting on land. So if they would have laid their eggs on land, it would have been a higher likelihood that the eggs would have hatched and then formed sort of the next generation of animals. So I think those are two pretty good reasons why you would have had the amphibians turn into reptiles. Okay, cool. I think that's good. That's enough of me lecturing. You guys have been listening for quite some time. Here, that lecture was 42 minutes.